What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you are tuned in to Kinda Neat. Thank you for tuning in, as always. First things first, if you are a weekly listener, you know the drilly by now. Go to patreon.com/kindaneat. I know you haven't done it. That's why you're listening to this part. If you had done it, you would have already fast-forwarded past this. So I know that your guilty conscience is weighing in on you that you've never supported the podcast or you've never supported the YouTube channel. And so you're going to want to go to patreon.com/kindaneat and just pledge $1 per episode. That's the way it works. Every time we release an episode, some sneaky little elf will take out $1 from your bank account and put it into our PayPal account, and that will be $4 taken out of your bank account by that elf every month. So it's about buying me like a latte or something like that. So buy me a coffee every month by going to patreon.com/kindaneat. Helps us keep the lights on here, and it helps me buy more fucking, you know, vociferous gold chains and rings and other such items that I don't need, but that make me look cool. All right, so I'm not going to talk that much more on this intro because I just did a podcast yesterday and I don't have nothing new in my life happened. I haven't thought of anything to talk about. But also, we have a super OG, Kenny Siegel, on the show, who is a beat maker and just all around musician. But he's also a bit of a historian, as you find out in this episode. He's been around the Los Angeles rap scene and various types of music scenes, from drum and bass to the beat scene to the, you know, the mid-2000s rap scene. And he's managed to, like, maintain a career throughout the entire time delving in all these scenes. And he's also just managed to maintain, like, an influence amongst these scenes and a high standing in these scenes for 20 years now. So there's tons of history that we talk about, and it gets pretty it gets pretty intense as far as like names and stuff like that. And we go through a bunch of people. It's kind of inside baseball because he and I know a lot of people similar that have not been brought up on the podcast or that are like pretty regional people. So if that gets confusing, my bad. But you know what you can do? You can just Google, and every time he says a name, you can make your own little fucking footnote to follow along with. But even if you don't know all the people that we're talking about, I think it was interesting as shit, and it was a really cool conversation, and the history ran deep, and I love hearing about Los Angeles hip-hop history. So without further ado, I'm going to get right into my podcast with producer from Team Supreme. He's also the producer recently of Bus Driver's, I think a lot of Bus Driver's last record. I know he's a producer on or that did the whole thing of Milo's So the Flies Come, and just various other projects throughout the years. So this is a producer named Kenny Siegel, and this is his Kinda Neat episode. Kenny.
Yo.
So Kenny, I don't know, you from Beat Team Supreme, yeah?
Yeah.
But like, that's kind of a newer thing for you.
Yeah, that's kind of like relative to like my whole career, at least. It's kind of like the second act or the third act or something.
Right.
I mean, I moved out here in 97 for college.
Yeah. Where'd you go?
I was going to USC.
Uh-huh.
And at USC, I was going at the same time as like Daedalus and Edit from the Glitch Mob.
Yeah.
And we were all in the drum and bass back then, and I was in a drum and bass crew that we were originally called the Helium Crew, and then we were called On Point.
Uh-huh.
And that's how, like, me and Ed kind of were making music together, and that's how Concrete Jungle, way before
Kev's thing,
Low End Theory, Kev was doing Concrete Jungle. We all used to go up there, and that's how I met a lot of the Project Blood MCs. So through that, I kind of started making hip-hop. And I think Kev actually brought Peace over to my house back when Peace was one of the residents at Concrete Jungle, or over to my dorm room, basically, to buy weed for my roommate at the time. And then we all ended up working on a song, or Peace ended up rapping on a beat I was doing that day called Faking the Funk. And that was like the first song I ever recorded with an MC, actually.
No shit. What year was that?
I was maybe like 97, 98. Or no, I moved here in 97. That had to have been like 99 probably.
Yeah, so you'd been here for a minute and you were doing your thing in the drum and bass scene. And then just serendipitous happens and you meet Peace.
Yeah, he just came over to my house. And at that point, I didn't think of music in genres as much. I mean, I was a drum and bass DJ, but as far as my beats, like I was just making beats. So like I didn't think of it like I was making a hip hop beat right now or making a drum. I was just kind of making stuff. So.
Right. How long had you been DJing at that point?
I mean, I started learning back when I grew up in Maryland in D.C. Like, my last, like, 2 or 3 years of high school, I met this guy who made beats, and he was a drum and bass DJ and a graffiti artist. So he was teaching me a lot. Like, there was a couple of us that would just basically hang out. He had kind of dropped out of high school but had this apartment that his parents were paying. I forget exactly what the deal was, but he had an unsupervised apartment where we could all go and like hang out and learn and smoke blunts all day. So
and he was like underage to be having his own apartment?
No, he was like 18 or not. Yeah. He was a few years older than me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was definitely some like kind of little like, I mean, it was like an artistic delinquent scene, but it was definitely like a weird little delinquent situation. Yeah.
So you're from D.C.?
Yeah, well, Maryland's like
what
the outskirts. Montgomery County, like Rockville, Maryland.
Okay. Rockville, Maryland.
Yeah.
Were you always there, born and raised there?
I mean, I was born in Silver Spring or Kent Mill, like all around that area. Yeah,
right,
like Montgomery County. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. What did your folks do?
My dad is a lawyer, but he's like personal injury, kind of like a private practice, kind of small-time little thing. And then my mom...
Is that like an ambulance chaser? Or
no, not like that. But like, I just mean like he does like small criminal cases I think he doesn't really do divorce or anything like that, but like just kind of all sorts of that type of stuff. And then my mom, she was a housewife / now she works at his office. Kids are all grown.
Brothers and sisters?
I got one sister who's younger, but I'm old, so she's pretty old at this point.
Right. I know. I like always refer to my little brother, and he's like 32.
Right, exactly. It's like my little sister, but she's 31.
So I'm trying to like use the word younger rather than little.
But, yeah.
So what's growing up in Maryland like? Like, what were you into as a kid? Were you always like, were you like the oddball rap kid?
No, my hip hop reference was the guy who drove me to high school for most of high school was huge Wu-Tang and Gangstar and J-Ru the Damager, like the whole DJ Premier like clique.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he played all of that and Wu-Tang stuff constantly in the car.
Yeah.
I was more into weird industrial music at the time. I
like Skinny Puppy?
Yeah, Skinny Puppy and Nine Inch Nails and like Ministry.
Yeah.
And like, getting real weird, like Pig Face. I don't know if you remember
I don't know that.
That was like a weird rotating band on Alternative Tentacles Records, where each album would have a different like all-star cast. Like there's one that was like Trent Reznor, Flea, and whoever the drummer for Ministry was, and that was like the band for that album. Like, but yeah, it was all into like weird kind of I think a lot of that influences my music still, the production on that type of stuff. That was when I started realizing that production itself was an instrument kind of.
What's funny? There's this guy that I credit with like putting me onto a lot of cool music very young. His name is Aaron, and he was one of my dad's friends. And I remember like my folks would go out of town sometimes and he would end up like just camping at the house and fucking watching my brother and I basically. And he was kind of like an older brother because he was like younger than my dad, but older than us. And he put me onto like Rage Against the Machine's first record and like all these like cool bands that I'm still into to this day. But he had like a Ministry tattoo. And at one point he tried to get me into Skinny Puppy when I was like 13 or something. And I was like, I don't know if I can do it. It wasn't for me.
Well, here's the odd thing is I wasn't like into those bands. Like I wore their t-shirts or I went to their shows.
Yeah.
In fact, I was definitely not a goth kid. I was not into like, there's all sorts of shit. Like, in fact, I want to preface my liking of Ministry. Like, I know there's a lot of weird like
the goth dance videos. Is that what that is?
That, but also like I feel like there's a lot of weird like kind of racist elements in some of that shit from back then. Like I don't know, but I wasn't into that at all. To me, I just loved the music, and I would like listen to those CDs, and I would basically when I was first discovering weed, I would get stoned and listen to those CDs and headphones, especially Nine Inch Nails, but like a lot of those other bands kind of I like branched off into because I was just really into like weird noises. There was even this German band, Einstürzende Neubauten, I think is how it's said. I think it's in German, it means like exploding walls or some shit. And they would basically have like jackhammers on stage and they would make like weird music, concrete slash industrial dance music.
No shit.
But I was like really into the concept of all that shit more than the actual scene. Like as far as like my friends, I was friends with like some stoner kind of skater dudes, like for the most part. Didn't really feel my music taste at all.
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny. But was music always a big part of your life or was it just...
Definitely. I mean, I played like some early piano lessons and I played cello all through like middle school and high school and the orchestra and all that type of shit. Yeah. And I started making beats sometime in like maybe 10th grade or so was when I met that dude. And then I also, the other big thing was I downloaded this software that was like an early like MS-DOS sequencer on my parents' computer.
Yeah.
It was off of like back when the internet was like it was like bulletin boards and you had to like dial up on a modem and all that old school shit.
What was that program called?
It was called Fast Tracker.
Oh shit.
And there was like a whole scene. It was mainly in Europe. And what was crazy was when there was no MP3s back then. So when you downloaded a file to play on it, you downloaded the person's whole sequence with their samples because that was way smaller. Like just having the drum sounds and the like kind of their version of a MIDI file was way smaller than a whole long wave file of something.
Oh shit.
So part of the challenge was you had to make these complex songs out of like little snippets of samples because you didn't want the file to be too big. And then the other thing is you would download the song and you'd have the person's whole file. So that's how I learned how to use it is I was downloading other people's music. I would look how they did it, use all their samples and then make new shit out of it myself and kind of over the course of like a year or two. And then I had a friend who was trying to write like a video game at the time because we're really into like Doom and all that stuff when it was coming out. And I was working on like the soundtrack for his video game. Like that was kind of my first little forays into like music making, I guess.
That's dope. What is that program in hindsight like most similar to now?
Well, I actually used that program for many years. Even like all of Megabyte, all of the stuff I did with Abstract Rude, most of that was done in that DOS program. And I had a special old computer I used to save that could run it. But then there was a program called...
Well, why? Because it got a specific sound or just because that's what you knew
how
to use?
Yeah, because it was a combination of both. It was that's what I knew how to use, but it also definitely had a sound and it had such severe limitations in what you could do that you had these tricks you would do in it to kind of make things sound off the grid and funky. And like that, I felt early on was a large part of my sound was that software.
Which is funny because now like you brought in an SP-404 and I feel like a lot of people that use 404s, they use it because there are like these specific glitches you can make it do, right?
True. The funny thing is I only really use it as a performance instrument. Yeah. I've made beats with it, but I don't love the workflow of making beats on it as much. Right. Like I love the sound, but yes, there's certain sounds to the effects of it that sound really tight.
Yeah, totally.
And that they stand up to, I mean, I have all sorts of really cool guitar pedals. I got some expensive compressors and shit, but the damn compression effects and the EQs and the, like the vinyl simulator effect on the 404 and even the reverb sound amazing compared to like all sorts of other effects and stuff.
No shit.
But,
I always like tell you this, but you remind me so much of Mark, the Equilibrium that I work with all the time. And, I think you guys are pretty close in age too. And his story is kind of similar as far as finding stuff, but he always like takes pride in the fact like, oh yeah, man, like I learned on analog stuff. And then when I found out you could do it on the digital stuff, like I never turned back. You know what I mean? So was it something like that with you where you said your friend had like some analog stuff or whatever?
My friend, well, he had this drum machine. It was a digital drum machine. He had like, I think it was like the DR550 Boss. It was whichever one had, it had like four tracks on it. So you could have like two tracks of drums, and then it had like a bass synthesizer, and then like a kind of a sine wave synth or something.
Yeah.
So you could kind of make a whole song, and that was what I cut my teeth on, is we would...
And sine waves are the ones that sound kind of like buzzy, right? They...
Well, sine wave is more like the pure tone, like you're thinking of like a triangle. But in fact, you could probably choose what type of wave it was. It was any type of synth wave.
Okay.
And we would literally come to his house in the afternoon. One person would have headphones with the drum machine making a beat. One person would be DJing on the turntables, practicing beat matching. Another person would be drawing graffiti and or rolling blunts. And we would just kind of rotate around. That was like...
So hip-hop. Those are the
it was.
The
and it's funny because this guy's name is Cedric. He was a Chinese dude.
Yeah.
And then it was me, this Asian dude who was... To be honest, I don't remember, but I'm guessing he was like Filipino or something. And then this other guy, Dave.
If he was a DJ, that's a safe bet.
Yeah, probably. And then there's this other guy, Dave, who's now like a city councilman in like Maryland and whatever area he lives in. Like,
no shit.
Yeah, so it was like a weird ragtag bunch of us over there.
So did you get good at DJing? Like, do you know how to like DJ?
Yeah, I mean, I got much better when I moved out here because... When I first linked up in college with the Helium crew and then we became On Point, I met this guy, DJ Prolifics, who kind of became my sensei with like learning how to scratch and all that. I mean, it's funny. Back then, I thought I was the whack dude, and I was like the producer of our crew. Like, I had to be decent at DJing because you wouldn't even be in our crew if you weren't. Mm-hmm. But I was definitely like the weakest, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And now, as the years have passed, like, I feel my skill set is now like sets me up as like a strong DJ compared to a lot of
younger kids.
Yeah, but I've never thought of myself as like, oh shit, I'm like a dope DJ.
Yeah.
But I know how to scratch, I know how to beat match, I know how to spin vinyl, and I have probably 15 or more crates of it at my house.
No shit.
Yeah.
What inspired you to pick USC to move out here?
Hopefully my parents aren't going to ever listen to this podcast, but
if they do, shout out to mom and dad.
The weed.
Really?
I mean, real talk, I came out here with my family, looking at some colleges. My parents were encouraging me to go to University of Maryland. I was going on a computer scholarship at the time. Like SC, I had like a small scholarship in the beginning for computer engineering. And I spent a night in the dorms. It's one of those things where, like, when you're visiting colleges and your parents are like drop you off at the dorms for a night.
Those are like always the best movies.
And
you know what I mean?
I smoked real weed for the first time because all I'd smoked was East Coast like brick weed I'd never seen real chronic before, and I smoked it in the dorms that night and was basically like, I want to go to USC.
That's so funny. You know what's funny about that? Because in the 90s, like before. Weed was like so fucking scientific like it is now, and like there's just good weed everywhere. That was a real concern with people where I was from Alaska, and I would come to visit my cousins in California, and they would have great weed, but then they would hear like, oh, you're from Alaska? Holy shit, man, Matanuska Thunderfuck, like blueberry, like
there was regional weed.
Right,
yeah.
Regional weeds are like, you get MTF, man, do you get blueberry? It's like, I guess, yeah, you know?
Man, the summer after my freshman year, I brought probably about 2 ounces back to Maryland. That was like the only time, I think, once college started that I came back for the full summer.
And you were like the most popular kid in Maryland.
We went up to University of Maryland. People. The funny thing is I didn't want to sell any of it because I wanted that for the whole summer.
Yeah.
People were offering me like 40, 50 bucks a gram for it. Like they had never seen anything like that.
Really?
And the funny thing is back then there was no security. Like I had it in like my pockets on the airplane. Wasn't even a big deal.
Dude, I went to France for like a school trip in high school, and I flew back with hash on me in my jacket pocket, like not even tripping. There
right,
was like no
then,
security.
That was like
then.
It was safer to have it, I think, on you back then than in your bag because
absolutely.
It just you weren't gonna really get.
There wasn't drug dogs, and there wasn't fucking there. Like, there's no X-ray things to. Oh, there's an X-ray thing, but it was like whatever, you know.
Yeah, I just don't remember security being a concern back then.
Right,
like,
totally. That's hilarious. Yeah, I remember
one thing before we move on back to what you said about Mark. One interesting thing is when I first moved out here, one of my good friends from high school was actually a really big fan of whatever like the first thing that you must have done with Mark was.
Really?
Because his name is Jeff Tobias, and he's friends with like the band Lake Trout, and he's also friend. Do you know like C's Mike?
I do know C's Mike.
Yeah, so he's friends with C's Mike. He produced a little bit on his own, but like he was more just a fan. But he was a big fan, and he used to always talk to me about, like, how excited he was. And did, like, Mark did something with No Can Do back then too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so the first time that I met, or the first time that, like, I really met No Can Do, yeah, like, he just stayed at my house for a week and recorded this thing called the Impatient EP, and we became close friends.
Right, so when I first met James out here,
yeah,
I remember Jeff from back in Maryland was super excited because he's like, wait, that's the guy that worked with Equilibrium, like, yeah, that's so,
yeah,
dope, like,
yeah,
so,
yeah,
it's funny that I have, like, way back then, like, this weird little,
that's great, that was, like, literally in 2003.
Yeah, this is, yeah, long way time back ago. In the day,
yeah, yeah, yeah. That's funny, what a small world. So the weed brings you out. How did you get a computer engineering degree?
I ended up switching. Yeah, well, I was really into computers at the time.
How do you even, like, get a scholarship for that, though?
I forget, to just, be like, honest. I was good at taking tests. I had, like, mediocre grades, but I had really good SATs, if I remember.
Really?
Correct.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was always a slacker in school, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's funny, even my freshman year when I was a computer major,
yeah,
I was stoned out of my mind in class. I wasn't paying attention at all, but I was good at writing the programs.
Yeah.
And I tell you, the day before something was due, all of the nerdiest dudes would be at my dorm, like, asking me to help them, like, fix,
really,
their shit.
Yeah.
And, like, it was so funny to me because, like, in class I was, like, a pariah because I would often be, like, so stoned that I'd be, like, either asleep or, like, falling out of my chair or doing, like, weird, I don't know. That was back when I was much more loose with my,
Is that how you were in high school and shit too?
No, not at all. I mean, I was low key in high school. I definitely, like, I was a stoner the last couple of years of high school, but,
yeah,
like I was, I think most people's perception of me is that I was pretty quiet, not that I was, like, real crazy or nothing.
Right,
like that.
Right. But you concentrated and, like, got good grades and shit, or?
No, I did the minimum to, like, be okay. I mean, I think I was, not to sound, like, cocky, I was good at school, so, like,
yeah,
I never tried very hard,
right,
and I probably could have gotten really good grades.
That's how
if I was
by
to.
The end of my school. I took all the AP classes just because I knew I could half-ass it and get a B, and it would still count as a 4.0.
Right. I basically something similar, though.
Yeah.
I actually fucked up because I think I got a D in AP calculus my last year of high school and almost got my scholarship taken away at SC because of, like, that D or whatever.
Yeah.
I had to, like, write some letter or some.
Wait, so did you get, like, did you ace the SATs and get, like, 1600 or what?
Nah, I think it was more like 1480 or 15.
That's still pretty
good. It was good, but it wasn't
good.
Like,
yeah,
I aced it shit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like I said, I was a good test taker. I don't know why. I think you could probably give me a test on something that I've never even heard of, and I could get, like, a C plus or B on
just
it or something. Like,
abacadabra, abacadabra. when you say you were into computers, like, what other kind of stuff were you doing other than making beats on them? Were you,
I mean,
like,
I was also doing some programming stuff. Like, one of my best friends is a computer programmer, and we were kind of working on, well, this is back to Doom and,
yeah,
Wolfenstein and all that,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
texture mapping, which was, like, the early 3D games.
And that was, like, brand new then.
Right. So we were working on, like, in Pascal and assembly language, like, we were writing, like, a texture mapping engine, which is basically, like, the thing underneath, like, a video game.
Wait,
like,
you were writing your own engine?
Right, well, we were trying to. I mean, my,
yeah,
friend was the brains behind the operation,
yeah,
but I did have at that point, I did have a pretty deep understanding of programming and, like, and to me, music making and programming has a lot of art to it as well, because it's all about doing it in an elegant way, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, like I said, that original program I used, Fast Tracker, you had to keep your samples really small. It's kind of like using, like, a SP-1200 or whatever, like, where you only have, like, 6 seconds of sample time.
So they better count.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You're, like, you have to do it in the most elegant way. Like, you have,
yeah,
to, like, make use of your resources to make something greater than the parts. And programming, especially game programming, is like that, too, because it needs to be. Back then, computers were so slow, you had to make it as fast as possible. So, like, you can add two numbers together, but what if you just take the binary and shift them to the side, and that's the same as multiplying it by two? And then you could do that a bunch of times to do the same thing as adding the two numbers, but use a lot less clock cycles on the computer. I probably already lost everyone that's listening.
But I'm down. I like
it. My point is, like, it was all about finding, like, tricky ways of doing something simple to make it as quick and as elegant as possible.
And so what was the programming language back then that you're doing?
Well, C++ was just starting, but Pascal was kind of like what you learned before you did C++.
And do people use Pascal at all anymore?
I know so little about programming at this. I mean, yeah. I barely even know how to use my iPhone anymore. it's hilarious. Like, my desktop is full of icons, and I'm like the dude that I used to make fun of 15 years ago.
Oh, you're that guy where you just save everything to your desktop until I'm not really that bad,
but I do have a cluttery mess on my desktop, but it's not because I save all my files there. I just download
I've gone to producers' houses that are like, they like show me beats and their fucking desktop. It like gives me like an OCD heart attack.
Dude, when I was in college, I once went to the CVE shack with Jupiter. This is actually the first time I really ever hung out with Self Jupiter when he was briefly during that time. That was when he was still in jail and he got out for a while. And then I think like went back for a second, but either way, during that brief stint, there was this one day where he wanted me to like mix a song. I was like the young USC kid working with Peace.
Yeah.
And he brought me over to Rid Spot, which was the CVE shack. And they had this Pro Tools computer, and he wanted me to find the song, and literally the desktop had like a billion folders, and then in one of those folders was then like a billion more folders, and then in one of those was a session called like Untitled, and then Untitled 5, 7, 8, like it was literally like 20 directories deep. It took us like hours to find this damn song, I remember. And I remember chastising them like, yo, y'all need to like
organize,
figure this shit out. But the funny thing is, yeah, now it's 15 years later and my shit's all.
That's so hilarious. So when you get to USC and you're smoking your fucking reefer with your friends at computer programming, do you get heavier into DJing? Did you bring turntables with you?
No, but I quickly met at the USC radio station. So a little bit more history. Before Dub Lab started, there was KSCR, which was the USC radio station, which at that time in the late 90s, early 2000s, they broadcast on FM illegally. To most of LA, and that was the spot to have a show. Like Sunday nights, they had like REW and Curious had a show, My Crew On Point had a show, Assassin, Daedalus had a show, and then Daddy Kev and DJ Hive were the show right after us, and that's first met them.
Wait, time out, because I don't even think that doesn't even make sense to me in a modern sense anymore. Like, why was the FM illegal? Like, I've heard about pirate radio.
Well, because it was a pirate state. They had a license. You're allowed to broadcast just on campus, I think, if you don't have a license. Yeah. But they had a much louder transmitter than they were supposed to.
Oh.
But it was well known that like all the dope rave DJs all spun on KSCR. And like I even met like some of the guys from Wu-Tang came down once. Like they would have like legit stuff, and it was all run by Frosty and his brother Derek and Alfred Daedalus.
Oh,
they were like kind of the station managers back then.
Whoa.
So eventually the FCC shut them down sometime probably around like 2000, 2001, something like that.
And college radio still dope? Because I mean, when I was in Santa Barbara, it was the same thing. Like college radio up there, I think KLOS or something like that. It was fucking dope.
I don't know
dope.
If it's cracking the way it used to be.
Like, it was like a big deal when I was a young rapper to like go get on the college radio station.
Totally.
And like
being on CMJ was like a career barometer back then. Well, I don't even know what CMJ means anymore.
Right, totally. I would like actually call the college radio station sometimes when I heard a record and be like, yo, what are you guys playing right now? And they'd be like, oh, it's this new like Eli record that just came out, you know?
Dude, one of my early jobs actually was working at Spectre Radio Promotion, which at the time that was right above Vinyl Fetish on Vermont. I don't know if you remember that record store. Do you know where, like, on, like, Vermont and just past Hollywood, there's, like, the Extra Large store and all that?
Yeah.
It was on that block. There was a really dope record store called Vinyl Fetish. And above it, DJ Hive briefly had a studio up there. And then there was this company called Spectre, which I believe they're still around. And they were, like, one of the top independent radio promotion companies.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know shit about it. I actually had gone there with Ed from the Glitch Mob to buy records. And Frosty from Dub Lab, tying all the Dub Lab stuff in, he worked at Spectre, and we went up to visit him, and he was like, yo, I'm quitting today, does someone want my job? And I was like, cool, I'll take it. I didn't know anything about radio promotion or understand like the whole pay to play kind of aspect of it.
Right, it's very schmoozy. Like, oh, it was take us to dinner and do this and that and the other.
I was supposed to call, like, they gave me like the unimportant stations basically, but like I was the RPM director, so which is like electronic and hip hop basically. So they would give me like 200 stations to call, and I would literally tell them what they were supposed to chart and in what order. And the whole idea was we sent them free CDs every week. And if they want to keep on being on our mailing list for free CDs, when I tell you to like
play this,
play to chart Cool Keith's Black Elvis as number two this week, like that's what they would do. And it was funny because I didn't really understand. I didn't even know what CMJ was when I started that job.
Yeah.
And I only lasted there for about 6 months because I basically spent most of my time hanging out with DJ Hive at his studio smoking weed instead of doing the job there. It was an interesting looking back at it after I learned more about what part of the music industry that even is. It was interesting, like having had that experience, I guess.
Right. Tell me more of the USC radio stories if you have any good ones that stick out.
Oh, I can tell you one where Wu-Tang stole my weed.
Yeah, please tell me that story.
So I'm trying to remember who exactly was there that day. I'm pretty sure Raekwon, I want to say Ghostface, and like one other person was there at the station. And they had like a show in LA or something.
Right.
So my dorm was like right above the station.
Uh-huh.
So everyone, it wasn't for my show or anything, but it was buzzing around the station that Wu-Tang was going to be there that night. So I run down there and I bring like, and this is, I was like a poor college student at the time. So like weed was very expensive to me.
Right.
So I come down there with like my brand new looking fancy pipe from Galaxy Gallery that I'm so proud of.
Because back then it's like, yo, look at the glass. It's all right, inside
exactly.
out.
And then I had like my little gram of super nice weed and I'm going to smoke out Wu-Tang, and like Frosty had sent me to go get it, I feel like. And I come back and first they're like, nah, son, this is a crack pipe. We don't smoke out of no crack pipes because they're all from the East Coast.
Yeah, the East Coast glass, doesn't smoke out of pipes.
Yeah, they don't fuck with glass pipes.
Yeah.
So I'm like already deflating. They're like, yo, give me that shit. We're going to roll this up. And they like take all my weed, which at the time I thought I was going to like pack one little bowl for them.
Right.
I'm like broke. And then some shit happened where someone came to the station to get in an argument with them. I think it had something to do with like Loud Records. Like that might have been when they were like getting off of Loud.
Oh, yeah,
or
yeah, yeah.
Someone came and started yelling, and basically their security dudes just hustled them into an SUV, and like they roll down the window as they're pulling off, and they like there was some moment where kind of I was standing next to the SUV and I was trying to like be like, yo, get my weed back. And they just rolled down the window like, thanks for the weed, son. And then they just like rolled off, like, and I was just like,
oh. And that's so funny because like now people just throw like fucking full ounces at people and shit on stage. Like weed is like such not a big deal as it used to be.
Yeah, like I said, times have changed a lot since then, but
for real. Yeah. That's hilarious. So you meet Kev at the radio station?
Yeah, so Kev and Hive, that was, I feel like this is before even Concrete Jungle had started. They were pretty new on the scene as far as like the drum and bass scene.
Yeah.
Because Hive is also from Maryland. He had moved out here.
I know Kev, obviously. Shout out Kev. We're in his studio right now, and he is like a fucking mentor to everyone in LA pretty much
everyone.
Yeah. But I'm not that familiar with Hive.
So back then, before there was Alpha Pup, there was Celestial, which was Kev's first label, which was him and DJ Hive this MC Phoenix Orion and this other guy, Josh, DJ Troublemaker.
That's right. Okay. Now I remember him telling that story.
Right.
Actually.
And they all had like a falling out where Josh and Phoenix left, and then Hive and Kev still had Concrete Jungle. So they all started Concrete Jungle, and then they had a spinoff label from Celestial that was called, was Violence? I don't think Kev actually had anything to do with Violence. I think that was Hive's spinoff. But either way, my point is that was their original. Like, Kev has kind of done the same blueprint a couple times, I think. And finally, like, with Low End Theory and Alpha Puck is when it finally all clicked together.
Right. Because that's the sign of a successful businessman is you got to have a lot of failures before you have your success.
Right. He has a formula, and he's each time he's implemented it, he's tweaked the parameters a little bit.
Right.
And also, I mean, just like everything, there's also a little bit of dumb luck every time at the right place at the right time.
Totally. And he just found it with Low End.
Right. Yeah. But he definitely, like, he's from very early on, way back when, he was already kind of formulating the seeds of the empire that he has now.
Yeah,
I think.
The big idea, kind of. That's crazy. And so when you're meeting these guys, is it like, hey, what's up? I DJ. Can I play your shows or what?
Well, the funny thing is back then they were all jocking us because we were kind of big in the drum and bass scene.
Okay.
And my sensei dude, DJ Prolifix, Carlos, he was considered one of the best, like, scratchers. Outside of REW, he was probably, like, the second best DJ in L.A. for drum and bass.
Yeah.
And Hive's whole angle is that he knew how to scratch also. So him and Carlos instantly connected, and they used to come to – they had the show right after ours, and then we would hang out during their show, and then they'd come up to the dorms – and they'd scratch with Carlos sometimes. And that was how we first met them.
Yeah.
And that was...
And so were all these guys college students at the time?
They weren't in college, like, but they were college age.
They were a little older, right?
Kev is maybe like a year or two older than me, I think. Or I don't know how old Kev is, but I think he's just a few years older than me.
Right.
Everyone was young back then.
Right.
I mean, the other weird thing is, so Hive was also in... I didn't know this back then, but he was like an intern at Enterprise Studios back then. And when Abstract Rudin and I first became close, when he first saw Hive, he knew him as Mike the intern that interned on some of his studio sessions when he was doing, not Paint, maybe South Central Think Tank, one of his early, or maybe even Mood Pieces, one of his very first albums.
Yeah.
Hive was like the intern at the studio for it.
That's
or
crazy.
Whatever. Yeah, it's funny how... I mean, Kev also, I think, used to work at Thrive Records at one point, too. Uh-huh. That was maybe... I forget how that... like, all of the... Everyone has been doing shit since, like, the 90s, basically, that all kind of, like, interweaves out, like, with each other.
Well, and it's funny how people... Everyone who's been doing it for so long, you all stay in contact loosely one way or another, but everyone's path kind of leads to different places. And, like, while Kev is finding his success on the business end of low-end and still as a thriving DJ and just record label owner, like, you're having this second coming as an artist.
Right. I've been super lucky that I've kind of started, like, yeah, I've kind of found a home with some MCs that are relevant right now, where that really resonates, like, the stuff we're doing.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. Even like Elvin, how Elvin's kind of reinvented himself a few times over
totally,
the years.
Totally.
And like, I mean, shit, even Elusive. Elusive's another guy who's kind of had like a second coming recently.
Right.
Cause I remember jocking Elusive way back when I was in college, me and Ed. I remember buying that single he put out that had AC Alone on it. That had that really distorted song.
I mean, speak of the devil, I mentioned Eli for some reason, but I remember, I think Eli and Elusive worked together on some stuff.
They did. I think Eli was on that single too. It was like a Elusive vinyl that had that song. I think it was called like Electric something, that was the one that I loved. It had like AC Alone, but his voice was all like distorted on it or something. But I think there might have been an Eli song on there too.
Yeah.
But yeah, like there was a time when I was probably 18 where I was like, yo, if I could just be like Elusive and put out a vinyl with AC Alone, that would be the best.
Like, right. At that time, it felt like putting out a physical copy of something with like official artwork and everything, like you were on then.
Oh, totally.
Right. I remember thinking like, oh man, when my first CD comes out, like, oh my God, I'm going to turn this $1,000 into $10,000 and then like, it's going to be so on.
No, the real shit was when I did Megabyte with Peace.
Yeah.
Battle Axe got that in the listening stations at Tower Records.
Whoa.
And my parents were able to go to Tower Records and like
hear
see my shit in the listening station. And that was definitely like, all right, it's real now.
That's
like,
tight.
And the funny thing is, that was back when you got advances for albums too.
You got some chips off that.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. Like, people were handing, like, well, the whole thing we did with Battle Axe, Mad Child at the time, that was when they had just gotten signed to like EMI or whatever their deal with Swollen Members was.
Yeah.
And they briefly moved to LA, and he was literally like the godfather. Like, if you would roll into their spot in Marina Del Rey, you'd play them the first three songs for your album, and he'd cut you a check for $5,000. Like,
what?
Like, literally, that's what happened. Ab brought me there. We played him like the first three songs.
Yeah.
Ab even made me burn a different CD, I remember, because I had my favorite three songs in the beginning, and he's like, nah, he's not going to like those three. He's like, all he's going to listen to is three. Let me put these three songs in the front.
Wow.
And like, we went there, and yeah, he like wrote us a check.
Is this when you're already out of college?
Yeah, that was like towards the end of college, I think. Like,
did you end up graduating college?
I did. Like, there was a moment where I switched to the music school, and then there was a moment where I really felt like it didn't make sense. But most of how I was able to go to SC is yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
though I was in the recording program there.
Oh, okay.
And it was cool because I was the last class to graduate while they still had like an SSL console and a 2-inch tape machine and all that shit.
Yeah. So you got to learn some analog
stuff.
Yeah,
so I did get some really good knowledge from that. But anyway, there was a moment where I was about to not to, but my grandfather basically paid for most of my college.
Yeah.
And it would have just been like so disrespectful not to finish, even though it's not like, the funny thing is a lot of my career is based on connections that I did make back then. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that college was a waste because I mean, I met all the Dub Lab guys. I met a lot of people that mean something in my life still. Mm-hmm. But the degree itself, I don't think actually meant anything for my life.
Totally. I feel the same way about college. And I think that a lot of people that end up in the creative arts feel that way about college, where it's like, yeah, sure, you like had a bunch of fun and met a bunch of people. And that's what really helped you. But the actual schooling part maybe didn't do that much.
Yeah. I mean, the only time my degrees ever helped me was when I worked at an after school program. I got 15 an hour instead of 12 an hour because I had a bachelor's degree.
There you go.
Like,
yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. I look back. There was a long time where I thought like, oh, my college education didn't do shit for me. And now I look at the stuff I'm doing. And I'm like, oh, no, it all started to pay off. It's just like it took a long time because I wouldn't know how to do any of the video stuff I do or the photo stuff I do if I didn't go to school for it. So
true.
Anyway, blah, 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 blah. When you get out of college, what do you do?
At that point, I was still like kind of, we were making money being drum and bass DJs. I was working jobs like at after school programs and I was doing, I was DJing for Abstract Rude. Like I did a fair stint where like DJ Drez kind of retired from being Ab's DJ and I became his touring DJ for a few years.
Well, so, okay, then let's go back a little bit. I think this ties out, if this were like a movie, we were back to the scene where it's like, life's crazy. You want to see how I got here? Because you started with the Peace story.
Right, this is the Get Down.
Right, so the Peace story, you meet Peace, and does that kind of just like, that's what like, opens you up to the MC world?
Oh, yeah. So that just sent me on a whole tangent. So shortly after, the conclusion of
the... For young people listening, if there are any youngsters listening, Peace is a member of the Freestyle Fellowship.
One of the best MCs of all time, though, that's never gotten his due in any way, shape, or form.
Right. I mean, a lot of his raps would still fit in with what's currently popular, I would say. Like, he's a highly influential in a
quiet way. If you like
A$AP
Ferg, then you would love Peace, because I think A$AP Ferg sounds like vintage Peace all the time.
There you go.
So that sent me on a whole tangent. And the conclusion of the Peace story is, so he comes over and he does that song with me. Mm-hmm. And I was just like 18 or 19 at the time. I didn't know about what was going on. He was living on Kev's couch at the time. Mm. Kev and Hive had a spot called the Auditorium in Mount Washington. And Peace is super crazy too. He's schizophrenic and has like
multiple personalities.
Yeah, like some crazy drug and alcohol problems.
And he's gone on documentaries and talked about that and stuff, so that's not like new information.
Yeah, I'm not like putting him on blast or anything.
Right, right.
And this was the time in his life when it was first really, it's really sad looking back at it because we were all young. I didn't really even realize what was happening, but this is when it was first manifesting itself.
And that generally manifests itself in people in their mid to late 20s.
Right.
That's when that starts showing its signs. Yeah.
So he had what we would call a nutty at Kev's house. Uh-huh. And Kev kicked him out. And I get a call. It's like, yo, Kenny, let me come over and finish that song we did the other day. Mm-hmm. And I come over and pick up Peace, not realizing that he wants me to pick him up because he just got kicked out of the place he was living on the couch at.
Right.
And he literally lived with me on various couches of various dorms and apartments for the next 3 to 4 years of my life.
Shut up. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What's
so
that
changed
like?
My whole life because basically now I had a member of Freestyle Fellowship living in my dorm.
Yeah.
So like all the Global Flotation dudes would come over, like John and Thavius Beck back when he was called Adlib and Ino, Zagu, Pterodacto would come over.
Yeah,
like
I don't know if this podcast is making sense to anybody. That
these are all like
but for me, I love this because these are people that I was like scared of when I first moved to LA.
These are all like the younger gangsters of
Project Load
at the time, the young hungry dudes.
Right.
So they were all coming over because who are
like people like me and James and Dumbfounded. Those
you
are
the
OGs.
Next, right,
those
you
are
were
the
like,
OGs. I wasn't ever really a Blodian, but I was just around them. You know what I mean? But I knew to be like intimidated of those dudes who were like really aggressive and good rappers.
Right.
You know?
Right. These were the aggressive good rappers. So they would all come over. That's how I met Ab first. He came over to work on something originally with Peace, and then I ended up doing the song Birds of a Feather on Paint. Uh-huh. And that's how me and Ab, and then so in the aftermath of shoot forward a few years.
Wait, hold on. Don't shoot forward a few years. Let me ask you this. When Peace moves into your dorm, are like people, do people know who he is?
No, but people were scared of him. Like, yeah. It was so crazy. Like, cause him and do you know Joseph Lineberg?
No.
He's half of, him and Terrace Martin are the guys that did like most of Kendrick's last album.
Okay, I know Terrace Martin.
Joseph's
yeah.
the trumpet player, and he's okay. also played for like Snoop and hella okay. people. He was really good friends with Peace back then,
yeah.
and him and Peace would literally, I would go to class and they would sit on campus and just holler at girls the whole day.
Oh shit.
And then we'd all meet up and smoke weed afterwards, and like we'd come back, and actually the girl that I dated for almost like 5 years in college,
yeah,
the first time, the way I met her is this little Vietnamese girl knocks on my door one day and she's like, hey, this guy named Peace said that I should come over and say hi or something
no.
like that. I'm like, hey. So it wasn't her, but it was her best friend that yeah. ends up like becoming my girlfriend. Like, and literally some girl that Peace had like hollered at in the lobby of my dorm.
That's
or something
fucking
like
hilarious.
That.
How would he like eat? Like, it doesn't sound like he was working if he's living
he
on your couch.
He is
and
like
shit,
a superhuman person to be. Again, this all goes back to I was so young. Like, looking back at it, I say this stuff like feeling like bad about it, yeah. I guess, but he like wouldn't eat. He would basically like do drugs and drink a lot. Like he would often, by the time I would wake up in the morning, he would have already gone to the liquor store across the street, gotten one of the small bottles of Hennessy and drank it through a straw.
Wow.
Like that was how he would wake up. He would eat sporadically. He would
just like what, like bumming people's meal cards at USC or something to go eat at the in the diner.
When we
or
cooked food,
oh, okay.
he would eat.
Yeah.
He like, I mean, I don't want to make this whole podcast
right,
about
right,
Peace because
totally,
Peace
totally.
Has a really crazy life story
right,
about his
right,
younger years.
Right.
But he basically like never learned. I feel like a lot of like the basic like life skills of, or at the time, like it seemed like yeah, he would just drink and do drugs, and he has this metabolism that was like superhuman because he would ingest cocktails of things that would pretty much kill anyone.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't even seem to faze him. Like he would do like 10 hits of like I remember him and Kev and Hive all did some gig in Hawaii, and he brought back this vial of liquid acid, and he would do it like every night in a row. Like,
wow.
And he would do it with different rappers at our house. I remember one day literally I'm making beats in my bedroom. And I open up the door, and Peace and Orko, do you know Orko, the
yeah,
psychotic
yeah,
alien?
Yeah.
Peace and Orko are sitting on my couch in the common room,
yeah.
crying, like bawling like
together.
Little girls together
wow.
on like
holy
eight
shit.
Hits of this acid.
Oh
and I literally
gosh.
Just go back in my room, shut the door. I'm like, I'm not going to go out there again for the rest of the night.
What is your mentality like with that? Was it kind of like you were happy to have him around, or were you intimidated to have him around? Or like, what was it? You
a
know
mixture
I mean? Like,
of everything. I
yeah.
mean, me and Peace were, he was my best friend at the time. We definitely like were very close.
Yeah.
And I was one of the few people that could control him at the time too. So I also felt a certain responsibility sometimes. Cause,
right.
And I was having so much fun creating back then
yeah.
that it was like this, I mean, yes, there was definitely days where I was like super pissed that, cause
right.
also Phoenix ended up moving into my house too. So I became like, basically the dormitory
the
for people
for
that Kev
souls.
Kicked out of the
okay.
auditorium because
yeah.
Phoenix also lived with Kev
yeah.
on their couch and got kicked out. And at that point I have Peace and Phoenix and their girls all living on my couch.
Jesus.
Yeah. Or at least Peace's girl.
Right.
But it was, yes, there was days
like
where
there
I hated
people,
that shit.
There are people that have sort of this black hole of creativity around them that just kind of like sucks you into it, and then you don't mind it so much that
that's exactly right? what it was.
Yeah.
And Peace also back then, he would do a lot of crazy shit, but he was also the type of dude that in the morning would like have cleaned the whole house or something like that. Like he was one of those guys, he would break the PlayStation, but then he would like go buy some cheap video game
right.
thing the next day or
right.
something like
right.
He was always trying really
like
hard.
Just
to,
when I thought you couldn't get any worse,
right.
you went in, you know, like the scene from Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah, it was exactly like that.
That's so,
so yeah, and like you said, it was that vortex of creativity.
Yeah.
He was one of those people that was so wildly creative, and it was so much fun to
you
be around that creativity. That yeah, exactly, and also that was at a time when I mean everyone needs to like. Have their like shedding years where they just like work really hard and don't do anything but like work on their craft.
Right.
And that's how I accomplished that, is like I was either scared to come out of my room when they were on some crazy drugs, or just like didn't want to deal with anyone. I mean, saying I was never scared to come out. That's right. An exaggeration. But like I would just not want to deal with all the shit going on in my house.
Yeah.
So I would just stay in my room and work on beats some more.
Right.
And that's how you get really good at something. Like,
and so how during that process, you named a bunch of people that started to come in the circle as well, but that's around the time that you met Ab Rude?
Yeah, so I met Ab around that time, and then when the whole USC era finally ended,
yeah,
there was the house that we were living at, there was like a fire and we all had to move out.
No, that sucks.
Yeah, it really did suck. And everyone kind of scattered to the wind. I was living at my girlfriend's mom's house for a while in San Gabriel, and then we were recording a song for Ab's, Showtime, the album after Paint.
Okay.
And I didn't have a studio anymore because my stuff was on storage. So Daddy Kev told us that we could come record at his house. And this is when him and Danielle lived in Silver Lake at the time.
Uh-huh.
So we come over and record the song, and Danielle's all like, hey, like, I think there's a house. I'm telling the sob story about how my house caught on fire and I have no place to live. And she's like, I think there's like a house for rent right around the corner. And then Ab's like, hey, you know what? I'm trying to move out of my spot. And
let's,
we literally went and looked at that spot, and we ended up moving in there.
You and Ab did.
Yeah. So then we lived in Silver Lake together for like for the next 5 years. And that's when I started DJing for him. And that was kind of like chapter two of my career, was like the Abstract Rude years.
What year was that, you think?
Probably like 2004, 2000.
All right.
Yeah, 2004, because we went to Europe together in 2004.
That would have been around the time that I met you, too, because I think that I met you as like, oh, this is...
I was Ab's roommate. Everyone knew me as Ab's roommate.
Right. Well, I think Ab's roommate and Ab's DJ. And
right.
Like, James was around Ab and them a lot. No Can Do was around them a lot. And that's when he was kind of like my entry point into the LA scene, because I was living in Santa Barbara, but I would come down to LA to visit with him, and then we would go to hella rap shows together, and he knew everybody and would introduce me to everybody, kind of.
Right. And that's when I started working at Juice, which was when I already kind of knew James, but that was when we really got close.
Juice was like an open mic in Koreatown, right?
Right. It was supposed to be like an after school program, but it kind of evolved, at least the MC part of it, like evolved into more of like a cool open mic for people. Like Dumbfounded was really
right.
He was one of the only people that was actually in high school, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
Like James.
Lyra Flip, maybe. Would he go?
Yeah. Lyra Flip used to come. SP used to come. That's how I first met Open Mic also.
Yeah, that's one of the ways, one of the first things I knew Open Mic was like kind of involved with was Juice.
Right.
He used to ride for Juice heavy, like as much as the Bloat almost.
Yeah, because he was really into the, I mean, he's always had like a aspect of like community activism his career.
Yeah.
So, and even after I left Juice, he did some more stuff with them, because him and Ross G, they went to like Uganda. Like, did you ever hear about that?
Yeah,
and that was all
that.
Through Juice also.
Yeah, he has a great reference to that song, or in one of his songs, about going to Uganda and the radio host asking like, where's all the guns and the bitches?
Oh, that's right.
Music?
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out Mike. We don't shout Mike out enough on this show.
Yeah, definitely. Shout out Mike.
That brought up a good... Oh, and then there's Daniel Rizik. I know him.
Yep.
Oh,
so on some Full Circle stuff.
Yeah.
So my crew, Team Supreme, we just had our first show in over a year at the El Rey.
Sold out or what?
It was...
I'm going to ask that again and just say sold out and go, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, you had to show at the El Rey.
On some real shit, though, I feel like people throw out like terms like sold out very loosely these days.
It's true.
Like, I don't think before doors opened, it was not an official sellout.
Right.
The crowd was packed all the way to the back.
Totally.
I couldn't have been happier with the turnout.
Totally. There's really no such thing as a full sellout unless you're like a giant, giant act, because they can always squeeze some more people somewhere.
We used to sell the Team Supreme shows at the Echoplex. We did have official sellouts because we would have one of our biggest ones there.
Yeah.
We had over 1,000 people come through the doors, which is crazy, because the capacity is only like
it's
890 or something like that.
Yeah.
So like we had had people leave and then more people
came in.
Come in.
Yeah, that's tight.
But yeah, I mean, it was a dope show. But my real point is Daniel, from Juice. He now works for a company that does these like lighting rigs with these giant balloons where they have your logos on them, but they're all controlled through MIDI, like lights in the balloons and stuff.
Wow.
And I wasn't the one who hired them to do the lighting for our show, but when I get there, Daniel's there doing the lighting for our Team Supreme show, which was another one of those, like, oh, small world.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody starts off together and ends up wherever they end up, you know?
Yeah.
Very interesting. So when you're living with Ab, just tell me about that section of your life, kind of.
That was super fun, because Ab, like, that was during probably the peak of Ab's career, so like that was when he was constantly going out on tour. We would always have,
he like got signed to Rhymesayers around that time.
Yeah, that was towards the, I lived with him at the end of the Battle Axe years and the beginning of the Rhymesayers years.
That's right. He was like fully on Battle Axe. That's right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he's always been like the free agent of Project Blood, like with some of the out of town labels. But yeah, those were awesome years. We were right in the middle of Silver Lake before it was like cool to be in Silver Lake. We were walking distance from the Little Temple, or now it's the Virgil.
Right.
So we used to always be at the Root Down and like Sketchbook and all of that stuff. That was
Sketchbook,
like a really
is the OG. Like that's like kind of almost where like Low End Theory kind of spawned. Or yeah, like a lot of the stars.
I would say that's where
Brain
Feeder basically came out of. In fact, one of my biggest regrets is that was literally like down the street from my house. And I only went a few times back then. I was just wrapped up in so many other things at the time. It wasn't like I wasn't doing stuff.
Right.
But sometimes, that, like, when all of that, like, in the immediate aftermath of that, when Brain Feeder happened, I was like, damn, like, I should have been going there more, because, like, that was, like, magic was happening.
Yeah, because now they're all playing the bowl.
Right. Exactly. <You know? laughs> That was an amazing show. I went there the other night.
Nice.
It was good.
Yeah. Were you making most of Ab's beats at that time, or where is he getting beats from?
I mean, Fat Jack has always been his main producer.
Right.
I have one or two beats on each one of his albums since we became friends.
Uh-huh.
I was also engineering a lot, though, like Paint and Showtime. I did a bunch of the recording sessions and some of the mixing sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also where me and Kev also, that was another time where me and Kev crossed paths a lot, was on those Paint sessions.
Mm.
Basically, me and Kev were the two engineers that he would use on everything.
Who were you making beats for around that time? Or were you still working on beat stuff?
I was still working on beats. I mean, that was around the time where I made my Ken Can Cook album.
Ken Can Cook.
Right, and that had all the Project Blood guys on it.
Yeah, because, and I remember, like, James had a, everybody, like, made a song about food, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, I would
make a meal and then invite different people over.
That's right.
So, yeah, I was
this
doing...
This is when concept albums were, like, a big deal, you know? People wanted to have a concept. So tell me the concept of Ken Can Cook.
So, I mean, I've always been into cooking, so I would basically just cook a meal and then I'd invite an MC over and we'd eat it and then do a song about it. Some of them were fully literal. Like I had a big barbecue that was a posse cut where everyone rapped about barbecues, or like one song I made jerk chicken for Dr. Oop. And then he wrote a song that was all about going out with different girls and it's not working out. And then he jerks chicken at the end of the night.
That's hilarious. I was just trying to remember Dr. Oop the other night. I feel like I've forgotten more rappers than like most people learn about in their life. But I used to live in Pomona when I first moved here, and I would go to the Glass House, and so I'd always see like Phoenix Orion play like opening act and or like subtitle I would see Driver there all the time, like Tumex, like all those guys would just go to the shows because it's a half hour outside of LA, and they were just always trying to get stage time. But I actually saw Dr. Oop like play a gig there and bought his CD off of him off the street, and it was like one of my favorite records that year.
Dude, he's so good.
He's fucking dope.
So I have an album with him too from those college years
we
did.
Wait, which one?
It's called The Memoirs of Planet Lovetron. It didn't come out until 2006. We recorded it in like 2000 to 2002.
Okay.
But because of various issues,
yeah,
it never
this
really
would have
came
been
out.
Like when I was into Dr. Oop, it was like 01, and then I think I bought another record off of him in 03.
Right, you probably liked him when it was like Just the Three of Us was the big single he did with DJ Revolution, and then he had, or that was the one with Thess One, actually. And then
he had some song that had like a Lauryn Hill sample on that I loved so much. Yeah.
Yeah, he's super dope. I mean, I still work with him. I actually just put out a project with him last December.
No kidding.
And we toured Canada for it. He's always been like a real low key dude. He has a lot of fans out in Canada that he tours like a circuit up in British Columbia every year.
Right.
But yeah, we just put out a free project you can download from my Bandcamp or from my SoundCloud page called The Cuffing Season that we put out that has some really dope songs on it, actually.
Nice. Well, shout out Dr. Oop.
Yeah.
Tell me more about Ken Can Cook.
So yeah, Ken Can Cook happened. That came out on Project Blood / Decon, which was like the parent label for Blood at the time.
Right.
And that was also like further, that was kind of the, when I first called in all my favors, I've been recording for free for like everyone in LA for so long. So that was like when I was like, all right, well now you got to be on my album.
Right.
But it worked out really good. And then that was also the time when I started working, doing the job, doing the TV music. And that was kind of when my career, I wouldn't say it went on hiatus, but I definitely like...
You got an adult job.
Yeah. I mean, it was an adult job making music all day, but it was still like an adult job. So I didn't focus as much on my stuff. And then I was dating a girl who was a musician too. So I like was helping her with her stuff a lot.
How is it... when you are a music maker inherently and you get a job where that becomes like all of a sudden it's like now there are deadlines to make stuff, you're not doing it on your own timeline and you're like being forced to be creative on a schedule, does it affect the brainwaves and the creativity, or was it easy to just kind of like get it done?
No, it definitely affects it. I mean, first of all, having a job where you have to be creative every day on demand,
it's
an emotional roller coaster. Like it makes you feel awesome some days and it makes you feel like shit other days. And definitely there would be like an ebb and flow of like when I would be doing it, when I'd be killing it at work, I would probably not even work on music at home for long stretches. Cause if you make music for 12 or 14 hours in the studio all day for someone else and maybe made a lot of money doing it too, you're not really super motivated to work on your stuff, or you don't even know what your stuff sounds like sometimes because you've been working on other people's stuff.
Like making jingles and shit.
Right. But then there'd be times, though. I mean, my company, we made TV music. My specialty wasn't really like corny, like jingly. So like I'd more be making hip hop beats or rock songs for car commercials. But either way, yeah, like there'd be times where I would be doing horrible at work where I'd have like dry spells of not selling anything, but I might be killing it at home every day. So it would kind of go back and forth. Definitely it was, I mean, I've said this before, I don't think I'm the most talented of my friends that make music, but very few people I know could ever have worked at that job because of the type of pressure of like having to come there every day and
turn
make music.
On.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And somehow I was pretty good at that. And I learned a lot about both my creative process and just like myself, like having to do that like all those years.
Right. Well, so like specifically, what was it that like, what was it about that job? Like, how did you get it, but what did you do?
So I was a composer at a company. It's called like, well, they're called like a music house.
Yeah.
And basically they get hired by everyone from ad agencies to film directors to video game makers to make custom music. And they had a whole bunch of us on staff, and it was kind of like being on like Top Chef or Project Runway. You come to work and they'd sit us all down in the conference room and say, today we got to make rock songs for this Nissan commercial. They really like this Coldplay song. They also like this Black Keys song. They want it to be about this tempo.
So you get like mood boards kind of.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they'd be like, they really like the guitar tone in this song and they love the drum sound in this one, and it needs to have a breakdown at 22 seconds when they reveal the car.
So these are like big car commercials. They're not, it's not like some like, oh, come down to Nissan Torrance.
I mean, the funny thing is that sometimes those little regional ads are the ones that pay the most money because they use the same music on
for
every
like
different
years.
Region.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then you get different royalties for each one of the sub-regions of same.
Like, so you were getting like royalties and stuff personally for the stuff you made. It doesn't just like go to the company?
Right. Well, so this is how it was like Top Chef. We were all on a salary, but the salary was very small. But when you win... So they'd give us all the jobs, but there'd be like six or eight of us competing. So then we all go to our studios and we have like anywhere from a few hours to a few days to do this music.
Whoa.
I mean, sometimes you'd have 10 pieces of music a week you had to write. Like, so then you work on the music, everyone turns it in, and then the client chooses one, and that person gets paid a lot more.
Right.
And even that was weird because depending on the job, winning it could be anywhere from a few hundred dollars to like tens of thousands of dollars. And they wouldn't tell you ahead of time. There's no like way of knowing what the royalties are going to be on something. So it was kind of like you're competing against everyone. And then once you win, you have to spin a prize wheel for what the actual prize was at the end of the day.
Yeah. So like you couldn't like, regulate the effort you were going to put into it. Cause you never knew like which effort was
going to
pay
Sometimes
off.
The dumbest thing would end up being like the most money I ever made in my life off of anything. There was, we were the ones that sang, "We are farmers." Bum, 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 bum.
Shut the fuck up.
I mean, my boss wrote it. So, but all of us sang it, so we all got like SAG royalties for singing that. That shit was the biggest payday ever. But the funny thing about it is when we did it, they assigned each of us to make 10 college fight songs for farmers, like for the end of a commercial. Like it was one of the, like I hated working. That was my least favorite type of thing to do, like jingly kind of stuff. But they would tell each one of us to come up with 10 ideas, and then we would go from each person's studio, all of us singing on everyone's because we need a big group. So I literally sang on like 50 different versions of that in one day. I didn't even remember that particular one.
I'm like straight tripping that you're one of the voices on We Are Farmers.
That's literally why I own a house, dude.
That's legendary. That's crazy. No shit, it was that big?
Yeah. I mean, it was part of the equation,
Well, remember when I'm like, remember when Riff Raff and Andy Milonakis and fucking
dude, so when they sampled us. It, yeah. So here's some fucked up shit. This is back when my friend Andrew Jumba from Team Supreme, he used to work for Diplo at the time.
Yeah,
he was one of his like main. I don't know if ghost producers or collaborators. Like,
remind me, because I have a full circle story about that
too. Okay, so Jumba worked still for Diplo at the time.
Yeah.
And when that happened, it was part of why we were getting paid so much royalties on that is because we retained the copyright, my work did.
Yeah.
So farmers had to contact us to sue Mad Decent because we were the ones who owned the copyright and had the standing to sue. So the day after, I guess, we sued Mad Decent, on YouTube, the video for that song, for the Andy Milonakis song, said this song has been taken down due to copyright claims from Elias Arts. And Andrew knew that's where I worked, and he called me up. He's like, Kenny, like, what happened? And I was like, tell Wes, like, I'm really sorry. It has nothing to do with me or whatever.
That's so funny.
But yeah, that was totally some full circle shit.
I was gonna say, like, earlier when you were talking about the influence of Peace and just how like influential he was as an artist. To put it in perspective,
he was on Diplo's first album.
He was on
album.
Diplo's first record in 2004.
In fact, here's a crazy thing about that.
Yeah.
Is that Diplo was trying to, I had no idea who Diplo even was at the time. He was trying to get in contact with Peace.
Yeah.
And he called up Battle Axe because Battle Axe had the Megabyte album with Peace.
Yeah.
And Battle Axe told him to call me at my dorm room. And Diplo actually called my dorm.
That's so crazy.
To talk to Peace. And I put Peace on the phone, and that's how they connected
that day. That's so funny. The way that I heard about Diplo was in like 2004 or 2003. I went to Scribble Jam because that's where all the West Coast MCs would go to congregate over battle rapping. And Diplo was the opening DJ of like the very first night before it's even an official event. It's like the Scribble Jam opening party. He was like up in some fucking basement floor, and I heard of him because of that. I went upstairs to watch him. I was like one of the few people watching him up there because I had just gotten that Diplo instrumental album that had Peace on it. And so no one even knew who he was back then.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, it's crazy. Okay. So Elias, yeah, you guys,
I spent about like 7 years there.
Yeah.
Now I'm sounding really old at this point.
Who cares though? The personal, I mean, I tell people how old I am constantly on here. You're kind of taking a hiatus from your personal music mostly, but probably just because of a lack of inspiration.
Yeah. And like I said, I was still doing stuff. I mean, I was still doing occasional gigs with Ab. I was on a couple Ab projects. My girl at the time, Jay Natural.
Yeah.
So I was working with her on some of her music at the time. I was doing music. I just wasn't as focused on Kenny Siegel as an artist. And also that was that awkward time. Like, I came up originally back when the producer was behind the scenes, dude. Like,
yeah,
a producer,
totally.
There was no option to be an artist as a producer.
Totally.
And then during that time I was at Elias was kind of when that revolution happened where all of a sudden.
06, 07, 08, 09.
Yeah, like Flying Lotus kind of led the way of like, yo, you can actually just be Flying Lotus. You don't need to be producing for other people.
Yeah, there was a few dudes that put their foot down like, I'm tired of being the fucking behind the scenes guy and I want to be the star type of shit.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's basically when Team Supreme happened, which is probably around 2010 or 11 or something like that. And that was towards the end of my time at Elias. And I was literally at work one day and I saw them post Volume 1 on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I sent them an email and was like, yo, this shit is really tight. It's kind of like what I do for a living at my job.
Uh-huh.
Can I be a part? And it was being like at the right place at the right time. The funny thing is that they actually, I think it was Dane probably that was running the Facebook account. I think they emailed me back right away on Facebook saying like, yo man, it's kind of invite only. Like, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
And then like 5 minutes later, they sent a second email that was like, yo, I just Googled you. Your shit is dope. Like, we'd be honored to have you be a part of it.
Oh shit.
And then I did a beat for volume 3, and then they did the first La Cita show, and I met everyone, and we all just kind of became friends real quick.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those moments where everyone was just on the same page and getting really inspired by each other. And
so this is the beginning of the third act of your career.
Yeah, so that's kind of brings us into the present day of the Team Supreme era.
What was the catalyst that made you decide to stop working at Elias? Because that's like a steep cliff to jump off of. And I always tell people, like, if you're going to quit your job, you know, you just got to like jump off the cliff. And hopefully
I got fired.
Oh, same. That's how it happened to me too. I got pushed off the cliff.
It was amazing because it was at just the right time. The company was already kind of going out of, well, they never went out of business, but when I first got hired, they had 8 staff composers. When they fired me, there was only 1 dude left.
Wow.
So they kind of changed their format from being a staff company to being a freelance format company.
Okay.
But they let me go right when Team Supreme was starting, right when a whole bunch of things in my artist career, like, they basically allowed everything that's happening right now
so
to happen.
They didn't fire you. You got laid off. So
yeah, I guess I got laid off.
So you could still get unemployment and shit, right?
No. It was kind of tricky. It was a little bit of both because I got canned because they kept on changing the deal of what we were getting, kind of. And I made a big stink about it because there was one thing where they changed it and they promised us something and then they lied and they admitted they lied, and like I was the one who was kind of like they were like, yo, we're gonna fix this, but then they weren't fixing it, and I was the one that was kind of kept on holding their feet to the fire around the office, being like, yo, like, y'all need to fix this.
Right.
There was thousands of dollars they cheated us out of.
Right, and.
They basically had it was kind of shady. They had this meeting with me where they sat me down with the boss guy, and he very, very graciously like was like, Kenny, you're so right about. I was super polite, and he was like, you're right about all these things. I'm going to fix them. And then 2 weeks later, out of the blue, they're like, yeah, you really offended the boss man. You're out.
Oh, the worst.
So, but the thing is, I started freelancing doing a similar thing very quickly. So I never really got to capitalize on the whole I looked into it, and it was going to be like every time I freelanced, I couldn't get unemployment for that.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass.
It was going to hinder me more than just going out. And I was very fortunate in that while I was there, I was kind of killing it for those years. So I had some savings. I wasn't like out on the streets like, oh shit, what am I going to do right away?
Right.
So I.
And so Beat Team Supreme, or is it Team Supreme or Beat Team Supreme?
Well, it's Team Supreme, but all the socials are Beat Team Supreme.
Okay, that's why I always say that. I mean, I have, like, to 100% transparency, like, I did not keep up with the beat scene too much after, like, 2009, 2010-ish, like, because there just, it became so much. Like, at the peak of Low End Theory, there were so many people, like, jumping into that water that I couldn't keep up. And so Ben, for example, in the other room, he knows all kinds of stuff about various producers. I don't. So break it down to me. Team Supreme is like, I know Great Dane and Jemba Jemba because you just mentioned them. Who else is in it? Dot?
Yeah. So, well, the core group was a bunch of kids that went to Chapman University that were all in Steve Nalepa's class. Do you know Steve?
No.
So Steve,
I don't even know Chapman University.
So Steve Nalepa is kind of, he's about 10 years older than me, but he's a similar kind of dude in that he's like a connector of like he's been a part of so many different scenes and groups of musicians, like, and taught so many people. But anyway, he had a class at Chapman University, which is like a music conservatory in Orange County.
Oh, okay.
That was like an electronic music class.
Yeah.
And over the course of a few years, he had Jemba Jemba, Dot, Great Dane, Preston, who at the time, Preston and King Henry, and those two used to be called Virtual Boy, and they were on Alpha Pup and kind of had like a decent career on that. Now, also Mike Parvizi was in the class, who's Penthouse with Preston. But basically, he had this class where he would have them all make beats and kind of share them every week.
Uh-huh.
And when they all graduated, Mike and Preston, Preston and Dane, kind of for a joke or out of boredom, were like, hey, let's keep on doing what we were doing in class. And they sent around the Biggie sample of like my Team Supreme Stay Clean.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, everyone flip this sample and make a beat. And they made a mixtape out of it. And that was Team Supreme Volume 1. Mm. And it was really just sent amongst those people and then a few other friends of theirs. There was a party at the time going on called The Melt. And that was this guy Roger, who now goes by DJ Hoodboy, and PJ, who goes by Prom Night. They all had different names back then when Team Supreme first started.
Right.
And a few other people. Goodnight Cody, who was called Snorlax back then.
Oh, I thought his name still was Snorlax.
Oh, yeah. Now that he's like had some official releases, I think he realized that you can't be called the Pokemon name.
I feel like I started hearing Snorlax because of Lowleaf or something. Is that?
Yes. Well, you know what? Is Lowleaf and Cody used to be roommates back in the day.
That's... Okay, yeah. When I met Lowleaf, I think they were still roommates.
Yeah. Cody's another one of those dudes that's been in, like, I mean, he was also the bass player for the punk band The Addicts.
Oh, shit.
Which they're all, like, in their 50s, and the bass player died, and when Cody was, like, 19, he was, like, their touring bass player.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, he's done a lot of,
We're going deep into the circles.
Yeah, I'm sorry,
this is
going to have to be highly edited. This is going to be the longest podcast ever.
I mean, I don't give a shit. No, we're naming names, and you guys can sort them out with Google for yourself. Okay,
Wikipedia, take note.
I mean, the thing that I've found really interesting about you since you started with Team Supreme is I feel like you've had a real renaissance sound-wise. Like, I think that – I don't know if it's just being around a bunch of young motherfuckers or just that big group environment of, like, competitiveness, but there's a distinctive, I think – change in your sound from what I knew Kenny Siegel back in Ken Cook,
yeah,
which is what I was familiar with, and like the Kenny Siegel of like Eat the Rich, you know, because there's just like a ton of like bounce in the beats now or something.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of all the things you just said. Yeah. I mean, part of it was a rejuvenation of being around all these dudes that are, a lot of them are 10 years younger than me, but are just killing it, and so. It's that same energy that I used to feel when I was around Peace back then,
right.
Of this like just really exciting creativity.
Uh-huh.
It's some of that. It's also that like if you do this long enough, you start figuring certain things out.
Right.
And also part
of
it.
But I will say, if you do it long enough, sometimes you also like start to sound like an old motherfucker.
True, you do get stuck in ruts, but.
You know?
I feel like, I mean, like I said, I think in the beginning of this, I was also saying like Elvin, Elusive, a few of us from back in the day, I think have kind of finally found our footing in the new paradigm of how you do shit and found a sound. And also I got to credit a lot to some of the MCs that I've hooked up with more recently. I mean, me and Bus Driver always worked throughout the years together, but we became a lot more close in the like 2010 on kind of era. That's when I started recording all his albums. And then he brought me in.
Well, I think Driver's been having a fucking...
He's also having a renaissance.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He's having like a new career renaissance as well that started around... what's the one with
Perfect Hair?
Yeah, Perfect Hair. Actually, one of Elvin's beats is like the one that made me... my favorite Driver song is The Troglodyte Wins.
Oh, yeah.
That Elvin did. I fucking love that song. And that was when I heard that, I was like, whoa, this is like a new Bus Driver sound, you know what I mean? Like,
totally.
Yeah, anyway.
But yeah, him, and then he introduced me to Milo. Then when we started working together, I went on that tour, the Perfect Hair tour.
Yeah.
And just kind of, I've definitely hit a stride. I mean, my sound's always evolved over the years. Like, I feel like I've had a lot of eras of sounds.
Yeah.
In fact, it's funny because we talked about open mic earlier. There's like an era of kind of electronic-y beats that I made, like from maybe like 2007 to 2009 that Mike just loves. Every time Mike comes over to listen to beats, I play him new stuff, and then I'll play him like a few old ones from that era that never got used, and he always ends up picking something from that era.
I think Mike is like quietly a pop star, you know. He like, I look at his songs like Good Hair, or no, I Really Like Your Haircut.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he wants to make some dancey songs sometimes.
Oh, definitely. I mean, and that's one thing, that's another factor of where I feel like I've hit a stride recently is that music, a lot of the genre boundaries that used to exist have all kind of come down, and you can make things. I feel like it's the era of, not to sound corny, but like songs like Hey Yeah, even though that came out a long time ago, but how that kind of just transcended everything.
Right.
I feel like it's the era of that type of music right now.
Yeah.
And that's something that I guess I excel at, in that I've made so many different styles of stuff through the TV stuff and all the different hip hop and electronic stuff, and I can finally kind of use all of that together
to make a modern sound.
Exactly.
Yeah.
While in the past, I feel like that was something that kind of hurt you. Like, you had to be more like follow the rules of the genre and stuff. While now it's cool to kind of just have like a cool sound that you can't really tell exactly what it is.
Right.
And I think, yeah, that's been part of it also. Like, yeah. And like I said, I've been really just blessed to be around a lot of creative people that drive me. I'm definitely someone that I can be lazy and like a procrastinator. And like when I'm around people that Team Supreme, it was like a, there was a very competitive spirit amongst us, but it's like a fun competition, not like trying to bring each other down kind of competition. But that definitely makes me do my best work when I'm around that.
That literally could have ended the podcast, but I honestly still have more questions. So I want to keep going for a few more minutes because I am curious about kind of where, I guess, the beat scene. Is it the beat scene? Is that what people are calling it still or no?
I don't even know. Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is I'm out of touch of it too. Yeah. Like, I don't feel like I follow everything that's happening that much myself.
Yeah.
I don't like knowing about everything. I like kind of having my influences that, or the, I surround myself in the things that I want to influence me, but I don't always like try and check out everything.
Right. Well, so that was kind of my thing, is that by the time there was like Soulection and Team Supreme and We Did It and all these crews, it almost seemed like it was so intimidating to try and delve into that and like figure out what's what and who's who. And from, cause looking from a distance, I was like, it's all beats. I don't know. I didn't know. Right. Like, I didn't know how to like interpret it.
No,
you know what I'm saying?
I feel you. I mean, what's amazing is that all of that just cropped out of nowhere. Like what you just said, like all like, and How, What, and Where, like all of these crews all based out of this area, all in like, that's one thing that sometimes I look back at and like, we're so blessed the era that we lived out here for, because Los Angeles, from the drum and bass revolution to all of the, to the low end theory revolution to like the new era of the like collectives instead of labels, like we've been on the forefront of where everyone else in the world is like checking shit out for like literally the last like 10 or 15 years. And it's like one magical little moment after another.
It's such an epicenter right now.
Yeah. And we're very lucky. And to answer to actually what the question was, I can't even keep up with everything. Yeah. I'm lucky that I have a lot of friends that keep up with that shit. So I just like learn from them, to be honest. It's not that I don't have time to go around digging into everything. That's not what inspires me, is to like sit on SoundCloud all day listening to everything. Like, I am aware of like there's little pockets of things that I'm really knowledgeable about.
Man, I gotta hook you and Mark up. I need him to get some of that Kenny fucking energy.
get some of that
Kenny powers over.
Yeah, get him out to LA for a weekend.
I just gotta hook you guys up via email or something, because I feel like he would be so fucking stoked to hear about all this stuff. But has there ever been any good like crew beefs between like Team Supreme and Soulection? Have you guys ever like rumbled or anything?
Not like in the drum and bass days, my crew used to get in fights all the time. Really? It's crazy. Yeah. Like, shit is super polite in the beat scene. Yeah. Look, there's like been definitely like, there's like low key little things here and there, but and just in general, Team Supreme, one thing that's interesting to me is I've obviously at this point in my career been in a number of groups and seen group dynamics and been in bands.
They usually
all
don't
sorts
last
of things.
Very long.
They don't, and being in a group is normally like having like five girlfriends at the same time.
Totally.
It's really tough. And Team Supreme has 20 members, and somehow everyone gets along, and it's so weird to me.
That's cool.
That at this point we have, I mean, there's been maybe two big things that have ever happened in Team Supreme as far as like arguments or differences of opinions, and we navigated through both of them in the end. It's kind of amazing to me, this new era of the young polite guys.
Nice.
No one's from the streets anymore.
For real, everybody's from the internet. What's the new record that you just put out, Claude?
All right, so I just put out Kenstrumentals Volume 2. I actually put out kind of like two new records, because I also put out a new Cleaners album a few months ago with Self Jupiter.
Right.
So I'll talk about the Cleaners first. That's a group I have with Self Jupiter from Freestyle Fellowship. I've kind of like slowly through the years made my way through the different like Project Blood rappers who I've collaborated with. And the Jupiter album's really dope. I'm really proud of how it turned out, because it has the first Cleaners album was kind of like in a style that was like a little bit more modern than either of us normally do.
Right.
And this one, I think we kind of went back to our roots. It still has the feel of the Cleaners. It's still dark and gritty.
Totally.
But it has a lot more classic. I think if you were like a fan of Project Blood stuff, you'll love this album.
Nice.
And if you like new shit, you'll also like this album.
And does that come out on Alpha Pup?
Yeah, it came out on The Order, which is like Pup's like hip hop label.
That's right. He's helping like curate that.
He's one of the A&R for the label. Him and Elvin.
Sick.
And then my new project is Kenstrumentals Volume 2, which is an instrumental tape. On Dome of Doom, which is also like a Alpha Pup subsidiary.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that's Wiley.
Who is it?
Have you ever met Wiley before? Wiley is the guy with dreads that sells tapes and he does the visuals at Low End Theory.
He
has the merch booth at Low End Theory in the lobby.
I had no idea. Dude, I see him like retweet my tweets sometimes and I'm like, what is Dome of Doom?
Yeah, that's Dome of Doom Records, which is, it's like a tape label.
I know exactly who that is.
Dude. Yeah, and it's basically all out of love. I mean, Wiley's a super dope guy. Yeah. He's like really supportive of people.
Cool.
I hadn't put out a project on a label outside of Team Supreme or something in a while.
Yeah.
So it felt good just to kind of do that.
Nice.
It's just a fun collect. I'd already put out a Kenstrumentals Volume 1 on Bandcamp like a couple years ago. It's just like jazzy hip-hop instrumentals. Some of them are from songs that have come out before where the instrumental was never available. A few are things from my SoundCloud, but then about at least like two-thirds of it is brand new stuff no one's ever heard before. So
sick, man. Well, shit, it sounds like things are fucking going good.
Yeah, and this next year is going to be really exciting. I got a few projects in the clip right now that are going to be kind of big deals. Like, well, I got some new stuff with Milo that's really dope.
Nice.
And I'm working on some tracks with Sam Herring from Future Islands.
Oh, no kidding. I'm working on rap stuff?
Yeah, I'm working on his solo. I'm basically producing his solo album right now. And I mean, that's probably not going to be till like middle of next year that it'll come out. But yeah. It's really, really good stuff. I got a few things with like Serengeti that we're working on.
I love Getty.
Yeah, he was actually just out here a few days ago. He's just over at my house a couple days ago.
I know. Every time he's like such a mysterious fella. Like he'll like hit me up when he's here, and then I'll be like randomly out of town, or he'll hit me and go, "Hey, fella, what? How are you?" And I'll be like, "What's up, man?" And he's like, "We got to play catch sometime." And I'm like, "Yeah, let's do it." And
that's then totally him.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it's just so crazy. He's so funny.
Yeah,
I always text him about boxing stuff. We're both boxing fans. All right, I think like we've gone probably long as fuck.
Yeah.
So let's wrap it here by just telling the people where to find you online.
Just pretty much everything /Kenny Siegel. Twitter/Kenny Siegel, SoundCloud/Kenny Siegel, KennySiegel.bandcamp, Facebook/Kenny Siegel music.
And obviously,
S-E-G-A-L is Siegel.
S-E-G-A-L. So KENYSEGAL. Obviously, like a long pedigree in hip hop and beat music and all kind of shit. So if you just Google Kenny Siegel, he's been involved in like obviously handfuls upon handfuls of projects.
Yeah, the last thing you probably want to do after listening to an hour and a half of me talk is Google and read more about me.
Yeah, that's true. Don't read about him, but just click some links and listen to music.
Yeah, look on YouTube, too. There's some really cool videos that me and Jupiter have done for the Cleaners. And,
My two favorite beats of yours, it just from recent years, if people want an easy reference and are still listening, like I said, Eat the Rich. Love that fucking song.
Thank you. Love that
beat. And the joint on Milo's record with Driver and Anderson .Paak.
Oh, yeah. Actually, you know what? That one's on Bus Driver's
record.
Though that could have been on Milo's record. It was.
And actually, everything on So the Flies Don't Come, right?
Yeah.
That whole record is great. You produced that whole thing.
Yep.
That's Milo. So those two songs in that project that I just named, very easy starting point for modern Kenny Siegel.
Definitely.
Bang. All right. This is the part where I'm going to talk about my social media, and you'll look at me weird, and I just go, my name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition. You can follow me on Twitter at It's Intuition. Follow my man behind the boards, Ben Shim, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database, based with two S's, and he's being very patient. We're doing a lot of work this week. Shout out, Ben. Follow us as a unit at Kinda Neat. Tell a friend of a friend to like follow us on fucking Twitter. I want more Twitter followers, and I don't tweet enough on there, but just help me out. YouTube.com/kindaneat, where you're going to see Kenny Siegel perform a beat tonight with an SP-404 and some other fun tools. Search for that podcast app in your app. If you're listening on a computer, you're doing it wrong. Just like download the app, search for Kind of Neat, subscribe. Every time we release an episode, you'll get a little update on your phone. It's fantastic and easy. Leave a 5-star review. Shout us out. Tell us who you want to see on the show. What else? If you are a weekly follower, if you subscribed on that app like I just told you to, and you listen every week or you listen whenever we release an episode, go to patreon.com/kindaneat. Help us keep the lights on here. All you got to do is pledge $1 per episode or more. I don't care, but $1 per episode is more than enough to make us happy as clams or happy as a pig and shit. That's like buying me a cup of coffee per month, $4 per month at the most. So go to patreon.com/kindaneat. Help us keep the lights on. That being said, I think we did it, Kenny. I think we covered everything.
I think you did.
All right. So that's Kenny Siegel.
Very thorough.
My name is Intuition, and this was Kinda Neat.
Thank you.